Ian Barker is currently the Director of Coaching Education, Products and Programs for the United Soccer Coaches, the largest soccer coaches organization in the world, and has a wealth of experience spanning over 30 years. Some of his coaching experiences include winning a national championship as the assistant coach at the University of Wisconsin, reaching the NCAA playoffs 6 times and winning 3 conference championships while head coach at McAllister College. He's also coached youth national teams for France, Spain, Andorra, Japan, Holland, Jamaica, and Canada, as well as youth club sides for the likes of Juventus, Manchester United, Inter Milan, Glasgow Rangers, Glasgow Celtic, and Galatasaray. As a player, Ian won a US Amateur National Championship in 1992. Welcome, Ian.
Welcome. Thanks for coming along, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me, boys. Pleasure to be here.
You've got a load of experience there, which we're going to be hoping to tap into today. My first question is, I see that you have a master's in education for English and drama and a bachelor's in philosophy and literature. Yep. So how did the soccer coaching thing come along?
Yeah, so when I was growing up in Great Britain, I was a decent player in the, what would it be, sort of the 70s, early 80s, but I didn't have the mentality to take it to a next level. That's to say, I mean, sometimes I explain it like this, I didn't really have the mentality to break somebody's leg on demand, which was sort of a bit of the culture of the time. So that was very clear to me very early on that professional football or some aspiration was not going to be there. And then I was fortunate enough in the English education system at the time to pass my 11 plus, which meant that I could get into a decent secondary school where I got A levels, and then I went away to university. So that was obviously that at the time in that era, in that early 80s, that was a powerful thing to do. And I didn't have any vocation, so philosophy and literature sounded like it might be good to explain to members of the opposite sex when I went back and on breaks to see if people thought philosophy was an interesting, mysterious thing. But we played college football, and it was really good. And a legendary coach called David Sexton, who had coached Man United and was coaching the England under 23s, lived on near our campus because he had coached Coventry City. So David used to come in and coach us, which was amazing. So as a young man, to be coached by one of the stalwarts of English football at the time was really interesting. And then I was club captain of the university, and we brought the English FA onto campus to give us the FA prelim badge. And it was a lot of fun because you got to play and run around. And I got quite interested in the idea of coaching, but I was still playing very competitively with the college and some other teams. I had an opportunity to come to America on a summer vacation in 86, realized that you can make a living in the game in this country as a grassroots coach, indeed a high school college coach. And then I married my interest in as a player with this newfound interest in coaching and came to the States in 87 and was very fortunate. It was real serendipity, but I got a job working with the University of Wisconsin, which was a good program, Big Ten program. And that's what really set me up. And then I was able to continue to play and coach. And one of the tricks that I give myself sort of retrospective or in hindsight credit was I was pretty good at divorcing my soccer playing from my soccer coaching. So I used my playing ability to inform my coaching, but I didn't typically I didn't coach vicariously through my playing background, if you will. So I wasn't one of these young people that often just coaches because you get paid to do it, but really wants to continue playing. I was very comfortable transitioning from player to coach at a relatively early point in my career.
Wow, awesome. I think you wanted to talk about the privilege of coaching, and I think it is definitely a privilege. It's something I feel very, very lucky to do and to have kind of stumbled into, because I kind of stumbled into it myself. For somebody that is starting out as a coach, what is kind of your, say, most important message for them, or, you know, top three kind of things for them to think about?
Well, I was thinking about obviously the discussion before we came on the air, and I think a lot of it for me is context. So when I think, and I know your favorite club, so when I think of Mikel Arteta, and I think of Ryan Mason or Pep Guardiola and Jurgen Klopp or Greg Berhalter, the pro coaches, that is an entertainment environment, right? It's highly professional. There's customers in the fan base. So that's coaching at that level. In the States, we have the level of college where you're coaching full-time and you're expected to win as you would be in a professional setting, but you've got to marry in the academics and the student welfare. And then all the way down at the grassroots level, mum and dad coaches, not compensated, kind of the last ones out the room when they're looking for volunteers. But there are some commonalities, because I would argue that even the most cynical pro coach still has to have a relationship with his or her players for a performance outcome. And I think that goes all the way through. So I think humanity is part of it in every aspect, because at all levels of coaching, you are interacting with other humans and you have this sort of leadership role, this point person role, that at different times you are in front and other times you're on the sideline while the players are doing the work. So I do think context, but also understanding that similarity. Clearly, one of the most valuable lessons I learned early in my career was self-awareness and putting things in perspective. So as coaches, we take losses very personally. Sometimes we can get a little bit too high on the victories and take too much credit. And I think, and maybe I'm not as excitable as some people would hope at times, but I try to keep the wins and losses in a much better perspective as I advance through my career than I did when I was young. When I was young, I thought I was the genius and took credit for all the victories. And then I took defeats very hard and did some abusive things to myself and to other people. Nothing that would have got me arrested, but just a lack of perspective. I would question whether I had the mentality to coach at the highest levels of professional with the scrutiny those coaches are under. But I really enjoy the pressure and the scrutiny of coaching, you know, internationally with Olympic development teams and with college, because at the end of the day, wins are really important, but the long-term development of the player and the person is part of it. And that sort of fits my coaching journey for sure.
Ian, so I have a question for you. I've been fortunate enough to be on, I think, two courses with you. I think you were my lead instructor for my national diploma here in Portland with Ian from Bainbridge Island, who I still talk to every day. And also, I think I was with you at the special topics with Jose Mourinho in California. Mm-hmm. That was my birthday. Great course. Still made some great friends for that. And you mentioned, like, you know, you take losing very personally. Was there a point in your coaching career where you thought this is just not worth the heartache, the stress, the anguish? And what was it? And it's a two-part question. What turned you around to think, no, I love this. This is passion. This is what I want to do for the next 20 years.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. I've never strongly considered getting out of the game. So I've never had that kind of experience. But two quick stories that I tell a lot in these types of interviews. But I think for me, they're sort of powerful. So one is, we were meant to play Indiana in the Big Ten final at our campus if all of the seeding went well. However, Penn State upset Indiana, so we get to play Penn State in the final. And because of the seeding, we had one less game on our legs. So we're going to win the Big Ten championship. We lost 1-0 at home, and we had 9 men left on the field at the end because of some discipline issues. So I'm an assistant. I went home and I ran until I made myself ill because I was so upset about the loss. And I thought that was probably, in hindsight, not an appropriate response, right? There might have been better ways of dealing with that result. And the other one that I'll share real quick is, I was working at Wisconsin, came home from a training session, dropped down in the couch, opened a bottle of Leinenkugels and sat down in a grumpy mood. And my wife at the time said to me, "What's the matter?" And I said, "It was just a shitty training." And she said, "Well, what can I do to help you?" And I said, "Nothing. If I come home like this, just leave me alone." And I very quickly realized I just told the person that loved me most in the world that she couldn't help me, which is a really shitty thing to say to somebody. And also makes you realize you're taking the role of an assistant coach at Big Ten University maybe a little bit too seriously. So those are some of the downsides to not having that balance and that perspective. I think with experience, which really is time, I still go to our convention. I meet people that have won games and never lost one. I have zero interest in talking to them, right? Because either they're lying or they're not in a competitive environment that's relevant, right? So again, what brings me back at the end of the day is I can find football, soccer on television anywhere. I can talk to it about anybody. I spend my entire day talking about the game. And one of the stories that we might expand on a little bit on this call, I literally had a fella call me 2 days ago from Connecticut. Long story short, his 8 and 9 year old co-ed rec team had won a lot of games last year under a different coach, but under him, they weren't winning. And he wanted to be talked off the ledge. So, you know, I'm dealing with a guy that's a very successful businessman and all that, but he, you know, he's upset about under nine, under eight co-ed grassroots soccer. And so, you know, it's football. I got to watch the games yesterday in the Premier League. I'll catch some MLS. I'm a season ticket holder. As you guys know, there are too many expats in this country that aren't soccer fans from the home country, right? But they come here and they can make a living. And that's one of the things I'm very aware of, are Europeans, foreign coaches in this country that actually have no inherent innate, brought up with it, love of football. They've just found a way to make a dollar out of the game in this country. Unfortunately, I'm not one of those. I've played football since I was 4, and I've never done anything else with more enthusiasm than play football.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, I've been playing since I was 5, and just absolutely love the game. So, the shifting gears slightly, when I was on the Ohio University course, they spoke about the professionalism of coaching, and spoke about, you know, creating standards that coaches have to meet, like you would in other industries, like architecture, as a doctor, etc. And I thought that was a fantastic idea, just because, you know, when I look at coaching, I look at it as the game, you're teaching the game, but it's almost secondary because the level of players we work with aren't the top level players. So we are more in charge of developing that person and helping with their growth than we are in terms of making them a top elite athlete. And so having such responsibility in charge of such young minds and such young people, there should be a set of standards to make sure that we are doing the absolute best by the players that we work with. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that especially coaches like myself that are making a living in the game, we should go and get the qualifications. I think the qualifications are very helpful. I think they give you potentially really good structure and framework to be a better professional. However, in the same way that a medical professional has to go and get a medical license, a lawyer has to go, that doesn't talk to you about the person's integrity, compassion, humanity, honesty, authenticity, right? So the professional standards we're talking about in terms of pure qualifications, the more black and white, I'm a huge proponent of those. However, as you guys will appreciate, there are coaches out there with A licenses, UEFA awards that you wouldn't want coaching your players, mm-hmm. be they male or female, ages, competitive level. So that being the case, from my perspective, it's not necessarily a quantifiable thing that you can follow the coach around and tick off a list of things that he or she does. Some of us will be more demonstrative, more effusive, bigger personalities. Some of us will be more understated. But I think there are some, I think there are some really good things that we can aspire to as coaches. So for example, an idea that was taught to me a long time ago by a peer out of Chicago. In my program, it will be fair to every player, but it might be different because I might have a captain in a college setting who's been with me 4 years, and I might have a snot-nosed freshman that hasn't done anything for the program yet. Now I need to treat that player as fairly, but it might look different. So that could be impact playing time. It could be impact the amount of individual attention the player gets based on their needs, based on their enthusiasm for it. As we all know, be they young kids or college kids or pros, after a while, if you are lying to them, if you're telling them they're really wonderful and they perceive that they're not, or you tell them things about how you're going to build the team and select, and then you don't honor those commitments, players see through that. And I think that's where a lot of coaches at the highest level and all the way down lose the locker room, lose the dressing room, is when the players lose a respect for them or lose faith, not as much in their technical ability, but in their authenticity. So I think there are, to your question, Angelo, I think there are very clear, quantifiable, tangible qualities of a good coach. And then I also think there are these slightly more intangible ones that I think athletic directors hiring coaches, chairman hiring coaches, parents hiring coaches should be looking at a little bit more deeply than whether I've got a B license or an A license.
For sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So feeding off your comment earlier about the guy you had to talk off the ledge because of his toddlers weren't winning under him. Is there a kind of age group that you would say that talent identification is really critical, or should they still be having fun? I mean, Angelo's coaching 05s this year. I've got the 07s for ODP. And there's a couple of players that I think, and I've kind of coined a phrase where it's not a no, young lady. It's just a not right now. Go away. I do a lot of private training. Go away, work on something specific, and then come back. And then it's happened. Me and Angelo have cut a girl from ODP regionals. And the next year, she's the first name on the list. And I'm just wondering, from your perspective, with the experience you've got, have you seen a player that's like just not ready then, and then a year later, they're the best thing you've seen in a long time?
I think one of the most heartwarming stories I've seen recently in football is that Jamie Vardy, the striker for Leicester that has played for England, played in every single round, is the only player in history to play in every single round of the English FA Cup.
Which is about 12 rounds if you start from the very start, right?
Yeah, I think it's 13 or 14, actually. Yeah. But so for your listeners, the story is a young man that was not picked up by all of the super scouted, super elite academies of Chelsea and Liverpool and Tottenham and Man City, and played semi-pro football, working men's football. I think his first club was a steel company works team. And he got his professional break at 20+, and then was in the English lower divisions, went for £1 million, which is nothing, to Leicester City, and won the Premier League and won the FA Cup. So there is a poster child for probably as rigorous a filtering, scouting, development system as there is, probably in the UK, certainly one of the very top ones. And they can miss a player that goes on to be one of the top, top, top performers in the league. So if it can happen there, it can absolutely happen here. I don't, you know, obviously Messi, Xavi, Iniesta got together when they were 9, and the commitment to picking the smaller kids and providing for the smaller kids, I think, is something we should all be mindful for. I think in a lot of our development programs, looking at whatever the calendar year is of the window, so currently you're working with a calendar year of 05, you know, 05, 06, 07, but keep an eye on the July to December birth dates, because they typically get weeded out and kicked out quicker than the January to June birth dates. I think that's a very intelligent thing for a club. And then I think when you pick a kid, to some extent, they've made it, at least for the next immediate cycle. What you pay attention to the kids that are lower on your bench, and even if you have time, the ones you're discarding or not selecting, and seeing what happens to the next, and can you help and control that? Now, the challenge, of course, in our culture is, in the American culture, more so than other cultures, when you've made an ODP team at 14 and you don't make it at 15, the parents often say, well, we're not going to put you out for that again, or we'll play another sport. In other cultures, players will drop down a level and be happy to get more playing time at that level and aspire to come back up. We need to keep pushing that in our American culture. So to your point, your 05 girl or whatever it is, you need to say to her, we're not selecting you this year, but I really think there is potential for you to do this next year. Or I don't think ODP is for you, but I think you can be a good high school varsity player and maybe a Division III college with no scholarship is the right level. If you have that relationship with the player to help them handle disappointment, it's easy to help a player handle success. It's much more difficult to help the player. So I am not a big believer that I think you delay those decisions as long as possible. And certainly with ODP, for example, you keep the balls bigger, longer, certainly at the younger ages. So if anybody really had the magic sauce for this, they'd be a millionaire, right? And Xavi, Iniesta, and Messi was a unique collection of talent, certainly nurtured by Barcelona, but they were three very unique players. They haven't come along since, right? So we can, as coaches, we can take a lot of credit, but I think there's also some factors there that are beyond our control, which are environmental and just simple luck at times too.
We've spoken about Olivia Moultrie previously.
I'm going to put you on the spot.
just a little bit. And I tend to take the four pillars of youth development and make it into six. So I split the psychology and I add emotional and social to make it a six pillar model. So when we spoke about Olivia Moultrie, we kind of went through the kind of the six pillar kind of model. And basically I am not in favor. I think there's too many kind of moving parts. There's too much to look at. But I will absolutely put my hands up and say, I don't know what's going on behind closed doors. I don't know sort of how much playing time she's getting with the, you know, in terms of training with the team, you know, that kind of thing. But I just feel going through everything and looking at the bigger picture, I just feel there's too much that is moving, too many moving parts, that I think she should just be allowed to develop and be a young person.
Kid. Be a young lady.
Be a kid for sure. Yeah. You know, what I've heard a lot of is, well, if she's good enough, and it's, you know, it's not a case of if you're good enough, because you might be good enough technically, but tactically you might not be good enough. You may not be physically strong enough. You may, you know, emotionally not be able to handle certain things. Socially, you know, as a child in an adult world, you know, how is that going to affect the child? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm interested in your thoughts on this.
I think any of your listeners that are interested in this discussion should certainly look up on YouTube, No Hunger in Paradise, which I'm sure you might have chatted about on your show before, but it's a short documentary about the English academy system and how it eats up players and spits them out, and they're at the top of the game and they disappear. So No Hunger in Paradise is actually sort of a related documentary. I was briefly at some time at Everton, and they were telling me that Wayne Rooney spent about 30 seconds in the academy, and because of his prodigious physical tools and ability, they put him straight up with the men. And he had a rough go of it for a while. He had a very interesting go of it with Man United, where Sir Alex Ferguson managed him really interestingly. So if you look at how Ferguson managed Giggs and Rooney differently, but I think it was a reflection of their personalities too. I think that my biggest fear about pushing the players quickly because they can physically do it, and you know, we're talking a 15 you put a 15 year old young female or male into a locker room with adults, I think right off the bat, you've got some socio-emotional issues. You've got all kinds of potential challenges. You've also got the potential of resentment from the older players, maybe more experienced players, or now this kid coming up. So you've got that potential dynamic. You hear all the good stories about the senior pro that puts their arm around the young player, but you can imagine there's some other senior players that don't like that. You've also got the challenge of if the kid or the player is somewhat successful, what's the safety net? Because going back now to their own age group, there could be potentially resentment and they're not welcomed back because they sort of left and then they've come back. For me, it would be a very managed situation. So in an ideal ivy covered tower world, I would have, you know, maybe my senior team, my reserve team, my under 23s, my under 19s. And if this is a 17-year-old who's really good, I might let him go up to the under 23s for a couple of games, but then bring him back. So I would try to make it a more integrated thing. Obviously, at the high professional levels, the coach wants to win pretty damn quickly. And if the coach's life expectancy statistically is 2.3 years in a top pro league around the world, I'm going to use every resource I've got. I'm not really committed to whether that kid's going to be good in 2 or 3 years. The owner is, because they may sell them. Maybe the federation is, because of the national team implications. So it's a very difficult challenge. But I'm with you in as much as the socio-emotional long-term health of the athlete, I think, is as important to their performance long-term as their physical ability to handle it today, right?
Yeah.
So it needs to be managed.
I think we, on a previous episode, we put a vote out on social media, and we have different accounts where we're followed by adults and we're followed by the players that we work with. And the vote, two of the votes were very different. And one of them, I looked at the votes, most of them were under 18, young ladies that me and Angela have known for years because we coach them. It was like 86% yes, 14% no. And then on the other side of the coin, it was like 78% no, which was the adults, the parents. I'm a parent. My daughter's 2 years younger than Olivia, still sleeps with a teddy bear. And I'm just, you know, for me, and Angela's got 3 kids, I've got one, we're like, it's still too early. And I think you've hit the nail on the head where you're saying slowly integrate. I've seen her practice with the Fawns. She doesn't look too out of place physically. Tactically, she's a very smart player, but she's going from practicing with some of the best female soccer players in the world, definitely in America. And then she's playing with her 05 academy team that next Sunday. I mean, does she mentally prepare from going from playing with Alex Morgan to playing with Phoebe?
You've definitely got, and I'm not remotely qualified to speak to this, but you've got the challenges of female athletes in these ages and developmental stages and emotional and physical stages, as opposed to male athletes. So that's a context that you would want to get into discussion about. Also, and this is very crude, but I don't think it's unfair. A 15-year-old young male who's been in the West Ham Academy, hypothetically, who goes up to the first team and it doesn't go well for him, is going to maybe find some football somewhere as he comes out of it, can still go back and try to play semi-pro, whatever, and probably has been set up, his aspirations is to make that his career and to fiddle around with it. In the US, a young player in an MLS academy who forgoes a college scholarship because they sign with a pro team and then get sent down to USL when they're 18, 19 and get back up and don't make it, that's much more impactful in the American sport culture because of our dependence on 2 and 4 year degrees and postgraduate degrees than it would be in the UK. So one of the things, the story you're talking about, but one of the things that really scares me, the MLS academy system, which we're now starting to sort of see develop in the women's, modeled off of European models. But then you look at the broader US culture of our commitment to education for pretty much everybody. So what happens in a few years when we have a generation of young men and women who could have gone and got their degrees, they're now 20 plus, so it's harder to go back to university. maybe they didn't get in their contracts that the university was going to get paid for, so they've forsaken scholarships. They're not going to be professional soccer players, but they haven't got the grounding that you need in America to continue to progress. So this context, this contextual thing I'm talking about is very, very powerful, right?
Yeah.
To the context of whether the kid can handle it physically, emotionally, whether the club can help them, male or female, US versus European, different parts of the country. So you would never put a blanket statement on it. You would try to do it case by case. But at the end of the day, you know, what's a playing career for an MLS player, an NWSL player, 32, 33? So life is going to, and you can't all be pundits because there's not enough pundit jobs for all of the players retiring.
Yeah, I think just to kind of cap that off, we actually did talk a little bit about the differences between the US and in UK systems. You know, the 16-year-old boy that signs a contract, Wayne Rooney, for example, who is kind of a freak case because he was built like a sort of, you know, Staffordshire Bull Terrier at 16 and was, you know, a bit of a phenomenon. Not that Olivier Moultrie isn't. But I think he was definitely further along on the physical, technical sort of side of things. But he's even had his problems, which you could kind of put down to, you know, have been forced to mature too quickly. And so I think when you look at a 16-year-old signing a professional contract, earning 20 grand a week, 30 grand a week, compare that to in the US where, you know, you're not even going to get sort of anywhere close to that for your annual salary. It just, you know, it really puts things into perspective.
Well, and another recommendation to your audience is the Freddie Adu podcast that Grant Wall did. It's not a complete parallel to the situation you're talking about, but Freddie Adu, as people know, is this phenom. And you know, was the highest paid player or the biggest contract in MLS before he kicked the ball, TV ads, Sierra missed ads with Pelé. And his career, he had a good career by certainly the three of us would love to have a career like Freddie Adu did. So let's not rain on Freddie Adu's parade, but a massive, massive gulf between what was expected of him and what was put on him as a youngster and what he was able to achieve. And if you listen to the podcast, he's pretty candid about it, mistakes he made because he was immature. But, you know, he talks about going to nightclubs as like a 13, 14-year-old, I think with DC United. So they sneak him into clubs. That's not a place where a 14-year-old should be, right? By the same token, if he's at home with cookies and an Xbox and all of his teammates are going out for a beer, that's a big challenge when they come back together. So you can't win in that situation because there'll always be somebody second guessing you, but you can manage it. But there are plenty, as many successful ones you hear about, there are cautionary tales, obviously.
It's a great answer. One of the questions that we get asked by most of, if not all, the parents that me and Angelo work with is, with a country this big, why are we not more successful at US soccer? And one of my, I use a one word answer, and it's culture. The three of us grew up, the minute we could walk, we had a soccer ball at our feet. And dads probably took us, my dad, I remember taking a milk crate to the old White Hart Lane, standing there with my face pushed up against the fence so I could wave at Chris Hoddle and Glenn Waddle and loved it. My dad still lives in the same house. We walked to our lane. It's just not their culture. There's basketball, there's American football, there's, you know, just ice hockey before soccer these days. I mean, is it a fair reflection of the country's culture to say that's why a country this big is not finding success at national level or international level? I coached in India for 4 years without badges. They'd never asked me for one badge. And soccer out there is very, very popular as an audience sport. It comes fourth after cricket, 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 and hockey. And they're like, why is a country this big not winning anything? So that's my question. Why is America not finding the success at international level? It's getting stronger, but your opinion, please.
And I'm going to, can I add something on that? And basically let's sort of find out how you think the coaching culture also fits into that.
So the women are incredibly successful and the rest of the world is catching up, which puts a challenge on our women to continue to do well. But our women, you know, defending World Cup champions repeat. We're talking now about the men's game, right? So if we just limit this to the men's game, because I think our women, they've ticked the box. With 320 million people, but so much great athletic talent going to football, basketball, baseball, maybe ice hockey first, it's not the case that you look at the UK with 65 million and theoretically America should be exponentially stronger because there's a lot of talent creamed off, which is not the case in a country where soccer would be the number one sport, which is many countries in the world, obviously. So that's a challenge. The historical lack of a bona fide professional league, I'm not counting NASL, with all due respect, is amazingly impactful if you think about it, right? So when Alexi Lalas played in the 94 World Cup here, where we hosted, he had never played a professional game. So the 1990 team was very famous for being a group of collegians under Bob Gansler. And even Milutinovic's 94 team, as the host of the World Cup, was not full of bona fide, long-serving professional players. And in 98, Steve Sampson took a team to France that still had very recent collegians playing in that. If you go to 2014, when England did not qualify for the next round, nor did Italy, nor did Spain, America did, US did, and we were very disappointed we didn't beat Ghana, whoever the hell it was, I can't remember who it was. But we did. Half the squad then had played at least 2 years of American college soccer. So as recently as 2014, the lack of a professional league, the lack of somewhere for the top players in this country to develop and grow was not there. So I think MLS will be huge in doing this. The other big challenge is I challenge you to find any country in the world where the debate about playing style, should we be more Latin? Should we be more Northern European? Should we now try to integrate African influences into our playing? I don't know anywhere in the world that's like that. The French have a kind of an interesting mix, maybe the Belgians now, maybe the diaspora. But as soon as you put out a team that has a lot of Brian McBride looking players, somebody will say, well, where's all the Tab Ramoses and the Hercules Gomez's? And then if you put a team out that's sort of half and half Hispanic influence and Northern European, Western European, somebody's got a problem with that. Do you play MLS-based players or do you pull in all of this American talent from Europe, some of which was grown in America, but much of it has never been to America, right? Because of, you know, American Air Force bases or whatever it is. So this country has amazing potential, but we are not at the point yet to realize it all, but we are working, I think we're working quite well towards it. I don't think the challenge to somebody like Greg Berhalter, though, of being able to get a national identity that people buy into, because I think, I mean, if you think of the top European clubs, the top South American nations, they have very clear identities. America's identity when it was under Bruce Arena, in my opinion, Bruce Arena gave it an identity. It was very chest out. We're America. We're a superpower in world politics. We don't back down to anybody. We're fast. We're aggressive. We get in your face. So the Portuguese game in South Korea and then the Mexico victory and then the subsequent exit to Germany in 96, right? That 96, yeah. So that for me, but I think as the league gets better, and USL is fantastic. I mean, the pyramid type system that's being structured here. And I think the other part is to go to parents of kids that are thinking they might be a basketball player or a baseball player and saying, yeah, you can pursue it because the salaries are pretty good, but we've got a sport here which we can marry in with maybe some academics, we can get you into college, we can cover your college degree, but you can go into a professional environment. Yes, you're not gonna make $100 million that you will if you play, you know, star running back for the Washington football team or the Dallas Cowboys, but you can make a really good living as a soccer player, and we've got the opportunity for you now. So I wouldn't worry. And to be, I mean, you've got to be the number one or two team in CONCACAF. You've got to be that, right? With no disrespect to Canada and Costa Rica and Honduras, you better be competing with Mexico. But once you get into the broader international scheme, there's lots and lots of countries like Italy and France and Germany and England, Argentina, Brazil, that there are there too. And I think America, the US is continuing to stay in that secondary conversation.
Do you think the current crop of US players is probably one of the best we've had?
Yes, because it's so broad, right? However, after obviously right now Pulisic, McKinney, Tyler Adams, and I'm going to miss a few, obviously. But that next group, you know, there was a lot of store put in Josh Sargent. I haven't really seen him very much recently. There might be a situation, and God knows countries like England have had this, where you've got a lot of talent, but not exceptional. And I'm not sure, I think we have a much, much deeper base of talent, but I'm not sure if you could pick the starting 11 in the same way that you could with, you know, the old Spanish team of 2010 and 2012. So absolutely raise the level, but there aren't, you're going to struggle if Pulisic and Adams and McKinney and whoever the other couple of names that could be thrown in there are your world stars. You probably need some greater depth.
Not as strong as your bench.
Yeah, basically.
Thanks.
So I want to just go back to you're speaking of the sort of lack of identity. You said under Arena there was an identity, but currently it's much harder to put a finger on what an identity would be. How do you think that affects kind of coaching education and that kind of thing moving forward?
Yeah, so US coaching education, and I got this potted history from Bob Gansler, so that's a pretty good authority to get it from. Mm-hmm. The original inspirations in the 70s came from UEFA, and they were German, right? So there was a lot of German influence in the early part, which of course is going to be at odds with, and then we're talking the 70s and 80s, integrating the Latin influence, if you've got the German influence. There were subsequent dalliances with the Dutch, Rinus Michels was involved for a while. And then most recently, US soccer coaching education, about 5 years ago, went very Dutch-centric with a mixture of Italian and German and French. So we've typically looked towards UEFA. And despite the heavy influence of Spanish-speaking football in our country, it's never really been integrated into our coaching education programs. Now, if you look at Brazil, they speak Portuguese, but you look at Argentina, some of the South American countries, they don't have the strongest track record of coaching education excellence. They have a really strong track record of producing excellent coaches, Bielsa being one of them. And typically there's not as big an interest in the formal coaching education as there is in this sort of European model, right? We've got kind of an Anglo model to how we structure it. If we created more Spanish speaking content, if we got more Spanish speaking instructors and presenters like Rene Miramontes down the road in San Diego, who's one of the best coaching educators in the nation, Carlos Menyovar, Roberto Lopez, there are many, many great educators that US soccer has used, but when they have been used, you haven't seen the response from the coaching community that they very often represent or are brought in to engage. For my part, because the majority of the people that come to us, English dominant, English speaking dominant, and because most of them look because they what the sport they when they watch the game on television, they're looking to Europe. My organization, we're quite European centric when we help, and we need to do better, right? We need to engage the African African-American community more in our coaching. And we certainly need to engage the Spanish dominant or the Spanish speaking community. And one of the things I'm really interested in, and I've had experience of failing this at this level personally in ODP, is recognition and resemblance. So as you guys know where you're living, lots more Hispanic families, a lot more players of color, and yet the sidelines look incredibly white. And at some point, the player wants to look over to the bench and feel a little bit of security that maybe the coach not only can help them with soccer, but identifies with them racially, culturally, you know, upbringing, shared experiences. And the example I've been using a lot recently, I have my impression of Scott Parker, the head coach of Fulham or the manager of Fulham, is positive. Great player, good looking boy, great. He's got such a diverse playing squad, and yet I've never seen a person of color on the bench at Fulham. David Moyes' first team assistant is a guy called Paul Nevin, who went to school in America for a year, actually very interesting, in Indiana. But that's got to be something we've got to do. We have to break down. We have to go and get more coaches that are representative of our player pool. We have to do that. And if that means changing our coaching education standards, if it means changing the content, if it means changing the instructor pool intelligently and not just keep giving it to the same older experienced presenters, but bringing new blood in, you know, it might be past my career lifetime, but it's going to have to happen.
Would you, like, feeding off that topic, as a young lady that I coached privately, who is now in your coaches, 30 countries, 30 coaches under 30 program, mm-hmm. never thought about coaching, super amazing girl, degree in law and degree in political history. I coached her privately. And she said, I think I might want to get a part-time coaching job. Now, she's ODP. She's an assistant at a local Division III college. She's high school. She's doing all the clubbing things. And she's doing her degrees through United Soccer Coaches. How are we doing with getting more female coaches? Because me and Angelo both coach girls. I've coached girls for almost 15 years. Angelo's probably the same. How do we get more female coaches involved?
Yeah, the women's side of things in terms of coaching education, our experience and what I've seen when I work with US soccer, I'm quite positive. So a good class would be about 20% of the candidates will be women. Now, given that over half of our players are female, that's still disproportionate, right? And I think there are many impediments to women getting into the coaching space, and I'm not qualified to speak about many of those potential or perceived impediments. But one of the things I do think about, which I am qualified to speak about, is back in the day, and it's still a perception now, when you attend a coaching education program, you have to be able to physically perform. So if I'm a really high-end 26-year-old female player, but I believe that the course requires me to perform, and I know I'm going to be in with male counterparts, that could be potentially very, very intimidating. If I'm going to be in a residential setting, dormitories, hotel rooms, shared dining facilities, in that environment, being in a minority, whatever that minority is, be it gender, race, religion, is intimidating. So breaking down those barriers. Now, one of the things that's been really interesting, thanks to the pandemic, is that my colleagues and I have done more coaching education, which is teed up and set up in a virtual environment. And we have seen way more diversity across all measurables of coaches because it's a little bit safer. You know, they get to, they're sitting at home, they have control of their pace. A lot of the learning is asynchronous learning. And we are going to get people together in person, but it's going to be shorter periods of time. Also, my colleagues and I are very mindful about trying to address concerns. And sometimes because the candidate, the young female coach or the young coach who's a Muslim, maybe they're not quite prepared to say, I've got a concern here. You know, what's the dietary needs of the course or what is the physical commitment to the course? We have to do a little bit of a job of sort of predicting and assuring people. So for example, on our courses, we're not going to fail you. We might not assess you immediately and get you through, but we're going to keep working with you. right? Your ability to kick a ball is not contingent on you passing the court. If I can start getting out in front of some of those things, and that word gets out, and in the 30 under 30 program, that's a 50-50 split. So it's intentionally 15 of the candidates will be female. So you can also do some sort of gerrymandering that way too.
Yeah. Erin is, her name is Erin Lutz. She's just loving it. She's loving the mentorship. And she's just like, every time I see her and catch up with her, what are you doing? I'm on another course. I'm doing this. I'm doing my LGDDQ. I'm doing my sports analysis. She's just a student of the game right now. And this time last year, she was just a student, just playing the game. And now she's just absolutely loving the courses that you're doing. So fantastic. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
I did my C license 2 years ago and I walked in the room and there was 20 guys. Mm-hmm. And one of the guys who is coaching high school here and a really good progressive club, he turned and goes, great, no women in the room. Let's get this done.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. And I coach 3 or 4 of his players and they say that he's a very this and that. So, and then 2 years later, so Marin, who is now my assistant ODP and worked with me and Angelo at ODP as well, she did her C license 6 months ago. And she said there were 16 women on the course, which is fantastic. And I know pretty much most of these girls, they're coaching high school here. They're assistants at ODP. So I think we're, you know, we're going up. It's getting better and better and better. And I always believed as a male head coach, spending a lot of time with a group of teenage girls, having a female assistant is just fantastic, especially when you travel.
That my experience and definitely my strong perception is the quality of the women candidates is extremely high. Because you tend to get the ones that have a lot of experience and feel safe and empowered. So when I get into a classroom with 20 candidates and 5 or 6 are women, they are typically towards the top end of the class in terms of their performance. And your experience with the guy that was dismissive, I had that experience when I did my A license where we had 4 women on the course back in 95, and it still persists today. But in general, just the nature of society today, that it is a more welcoming environment for all coaches, but it isn't exclusively the case, to your point.
I'll add to my experience. When I was doing my level 2 back in the UK, I put a message out, this was with Middlesex FA, put a message out to all of the clubs that came under the Middlesex banner. You know, I'm going to be doing my level 2, I'm looking for a club to work with. And the first club to get in touch with me was Enfield Town Ladies. And I've always had this loyalty where if you were first, I'm choosing you, I'm sticking with you. So I went back during my next kind of session, gave the information to the coach because they wanted to know who it was that we're working with. And he said to me, you're not going to pass if you work with a women's team. So I said to him, but aren't I teaching function and technique? Like, what's the difference? And he said, I'm just telling you, you're not going to pass. So I went on to pass. And kind of ever since then, I've been heavily invested in women's sort of football. I've pretty much exclusively worked
with same here.
Female players. And so, it was something that didn't sit well with me. And I challenged it and I continue to challenge it moving forward.
Let's put Ian on the spot for a couple more times. Ian, if you could coach any team in the world right now for one game, who would it be?
Arsenal.
You pick a really great team where you don't have to do any work, or do you pick Tottenham where you really have to push yourself?
where any modicum of success or intelligence would make me look good, I could coach either Tottenham or Arsenal. I think Liverpool looks a bit moody. Wouldn't be interested in coaching them. Chelsea are a bit too much of a machine for my liking. I think to some extent, Man United almost looks as many broken toys as Arsenal and Spurs. So within Great Britain, within England, I wouldn't mind having to go at Man City for a game. Leeds would be very entertaining. So that's British football. MLS, I'd have a go with Kansas City because I know them quite well because I'm a season ticket holder. And they've got a wonderful Spanish player called Ilya Sanchez, who is just a wonderful, he's sort of got some David Silva-esque Xavi, and I'd love to coach him just for a game. He'd be fine. And they're obviously the great club. International teams, it would be really interesting to coach, to be around the Belgian national team on the men's side. I know a little bit about American women's football, but I learned a lot more about English women's football thanks to the World Cup. So if you had an opportunity to coach the England women for a game, see if you could match up to Phil Neville's tactical acumen, that would be interesting. But I watched I watch more Premier League than anything else. Better production values in terms of broadcasting, good quality, lots of it, and I know everybody. And Man City are just a joy and he's got 20, scored 26 deep, so you could have some fun, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Especially when they had Harry Kane.
When they had Harry Kane. Yeah, coaching Lo Celso, Lamella, and Højbjerg in the middle of the Spurs midfield would not be very interesting.
Edit that out, Angelo. Remember that.
It's going right in there.
I appreciate that. I appreciate
your clip of that as well. Exactly.
Okay, well, I think we'll end there. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah,
much
thank you, Ian.
Appreciated.
Anytime.
I'm sure we'll see if we can get you on again in the future.
If you're ever in Portland, we'll take you out for a tea, a warm beer, and some fish and chips, maybe.
For sure. Just before you go, how can we find you on social media?
Oh, so the Twitter handle is at ibarkersoccer. That's the Twitter handle. The Instagram is Ian H. Barker. And then there's United Soccer Coaches has a LinkedIn page, but it has a LinkedIn group, which has about 30,000 people on it. And my company doesn't maintain it, so I just occasionally chuck stuff up on there. So the LinkedIn group is quite good too.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, everything, today. Thanks so much. Thanks so much.
Hi, boys.
Good to see you.
Have a good
Take care.
Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
So you can find us on our social media. We are on Instagram.
See you next time, everybody. 4 Miles, the Coach's Coach podcast, The Sensible Gunner, A9 Soccer, and Elevate Soccer, all on Instagram.
Yeah. And on Twitter, I am A9 Soccer, also Sensible_Gunner. We have 4.4M, as always, that's words, no numbers, and the Coach's Coach Pod. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you've got questions, comments, please fire them to us.